See, I have a narrow podium here. I'm relieved I remembered to wear pants. I'm delighted to be here, not only because it's the Fixed Point Foundation. I'm actually always happy to come to the South. I married a girl from Louisiana whose name is Dixie. And we met in the Reagan administration, where she now hesitates to point out she was then a White House intern. I want to make sure we got some time for questions, and so in my opening remarks, I will try to adopt the motto that King Henry VIII used with one of his wives. He said, "I won't keep you very long." Now, this new atheism that has sort of come upon the scene has somewhat surprised us, because at the end of the Cold War, we had radical Islam on the horizon abroad, and it seems odd to have on the one side a kind of militant Islam threatening us from outside, and then a sort of internal challenge within our society coming from this new atheism of a kind we haven't seen before. I think we need to take it seriously for this reason. For the first time in America, particularly among young people, atheism is now viewed as a legitimate or serious option. This was not true 20 or 30 years ago. In fact, 30 years ago, if you had to identify the poster face of atheism, it would be someone like the raging activist Madeleine Murray O'Hare, remember her, or some kind of a rumpled ACLU lawyer. This was not an atheism with mass appeal. And moreover, its agenda was quite narrow, to dismantle the Christmas nativity scene, to take down the Ten Commandments from the Alabama state capitol. The new atheism wants to go way beyond that. Its goal really is to discredit and indeed demolish Christianity, to eradicate its influence from American life. Now, the new atheists know that that's not such an easy thing to do, and they also know that they are numerically a minority. But on the other hand, they are also aware that they have influential positions in the culture and in the universities and in education. And so they have very consciously said that our strategy is to focus on young people. We'll let the Christians program religion into their children. And then when the children leave home and come to college, or when they enter the larger society on their own, it will be our job to use the tools of education to deprogram these religious beliefs out of them. We will use the techniques of liberal education, of skepticism, of questioning, of evidence, of science, of reason, and we will demonstrate that the approach of religion, and specifically Christianity, is the very opposite of the approaches that we teach our young people to follow. So, for example, science is based on facts. Religion, even at its best, is based on values. Science is based on evidence and proof and data. And religion is based on faith, what the atheists call blind faith, what the Bible says is the evidence of things not seen. Now, the new atheists are very cunning in surfing on the wave of current events. They've been very sophisticated in using current events to give a certain panache and legitimacy and currency and relevance to what they're saying. For example, I was recently reading an article by one of the new atheists, and he was discussing the war on terror. He said, if you look at this war, it's a war of competing fundamentalisms. On one side, you have Islamic fundamentalism. On the other side, Christian fundamentalism. What do these two groups have in common? They are both fueling their fanaticism at the same holy gas station. In other words, religion is the problem. He went on to argue, I thought rather wittily, that 9/11, he said, is, quote, a faith-based initiative, citing President Bush's phrase. And he went on to say that if you look around the world, you see right away that the main engine of conflict and division and violence and war is religion. Why are the Israelis fighting the Palestinians? They're fighting over religion. Why are the Shia fighting the Sunni in Iraq? They're fighting over religion. What about the Hindus and the Muslims in Kashmir? Religion again. What about in Northern Ireland, the Catholics and the Protestants? Religion. And, he argues, if you look back at history, it's the same depressing story. The great crimes of history have all been perpetrated in the name of God. The Muslims are only the latest installment, but actually the Christians are the greatest offenders. The Crusades, the Inquisition, the religious wars, the witch trials. So the bottom line is that religion is not only irrational, it is also immoral. It's had a very pernicious influence on human civilization. It is today a very toxic force leading to fanaticism and terrorism and war. We would all be better off without it. If we could have a secular society, it would be a more scientific, a more rational, but also a more decent and a more peaceful world. Now, this is the language of the new atheism. The first thing to realize is that in the kinds of arguments it makes a lot of the Christian apologetics of the last half century obsolete. This is not the kind of atheism that can be answered by, say, dipping into C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. It's not the kind of atheism you can answer by reading Josh McDowell's More Than a Carpenter. These are new arguments for a new century, and in some ways they require a new kind of language and a new kind of defense. Christians, in general, have a little bit of a difficult time with the new atheists, I think for three reasons. One, the new atheists are pretty suave. They come out of the best universities. Richard Dawkins from Oxford, the philosopher Daniel Dennett, Steven Pinker and E.O. Wilson from Harvard, Christopher Hitchens has a monthly column in Vanity Fair. So the new atheism has a panache that atheism hasn't had before. Second, within Christianity, and particularly within evangelical Christianity, for the last generation or so, it's very common to try to answer questions by recourse to Scripture. Somebody says, why do you believe this? What makes you think that? A common answer is, well, the book of Leviticus says this. The Gospel of Luke says that. Now, this is okay if you're talking to a fellow Christian. But if you're talking to a secular guy or an unbeliever, they're going to say, who cares what the book of Leviticus says? We don't accept the authority of the Bible to adjudicate the matter. And then very often the Christian is a little bit tongue-tied. We become, in a sense, you could say, naked Christians because we don't have an alternative or a secular argument to make. In a sense, I'm suggesting that Christians need to learn to be bilingual, by which I mean to speak one language in the church, perhaps, but a different one in secular culture. We have to realize we're living in a society where Christian assumptions are no longer taken for granted. We all have at least one foot, if not both, in secular society. We have to meet the new atheism with its own weapons. Now, a second problem, I think, and this is particular to young people, is that most of us learn our Christianity when we are very small. I come from India, and I'm actually part of a small Christian minority in India. Some hundreds of years ago, the Portuguese missionaries came to India with a Bible in one hand and a sword in the other. It was called the Portuguese Inquisition. They visited my ancestors, and they were very persuasive. My ancestors converted to Christianity. So I learned my Christianity at my parents' knee when I was 5 or 8 or 10 years old. But then at the age of 16, I came to America as an exchange student. A year later, I was a freshman on the Dartmouth campus. And quite suddenly, and this will happen to everyone, I found my beliefs under sudden and withering skeptical attack. Dinesh, what? Are you telling me you believe someone was born of a virgin? Walks on the ocean? Brings dead people back to life? Are you nuts? We're living in an age of science. Don't you believe the world operates according to fixed and invariable laws? You think these laws can be suspended at discretion? Or, Dinesh, isn't it true that if you were born in a different culture, let's say you were born in Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, you'd be a Muslim? In other words, our religion isn't the product of some kind of rational investigation. It's a product of the accident of birth. So how do we know that our beliefs are true and the other beliefs are false? Yes, but let me tell you what Jesus has done in my life. So what? Don't you think the Muslim is just as convinced that Allah is the true God as you as a Christian are convinced that it's really Jesus Christ? Now, in the face of this kind of critique, I found that I had very little to say, no tools to sort of defend my beliefs. And so I found myself pulling away from Christianity. Not that I didn't want to believe, but my mind was getting in the way. And this is the strategy of the new atheism, to drive a wedge between the brain and the heart, to make Christians feel like idiots for believing what we do. I've been really, for the last 15 years, a secular writer. In fact, to some degree, looking back at my life, I think that when I found my Christianity, my Christian faith shaken, I found in political conservatism a sort of solid empirical ground to stand on, and I've really been more of a conservative political writer for most of my career. Even this book, What's So Great About Christianity, I began in a somewhat narrow way as a sort of historical look at what Christianity has done to shape the West and shape America. It was while I was researching the book that these atheist books began to come out one by one by one, and I saw that they were making a much more two-fisted, comprehensive attack. So I expanded the scope of the book to make it a defense, an intellectual and moral defense of Christianity against this new atheism. Now, what I'd like to do this afternoon is focus on a couple of the strongest arguments of the new atheism. It's a little bit of a preview of the themes I discuss in What's So Great About Christianity. In debates, by the way, you don't do this. In a debate, you're up against an opponent, and I've been debating several of the new atheists. I've debated, I think, four. I'm actually doing three debates this month, including one with the notorious Peter Singer from Princeton. We're going to be debating next week in L.A. But in a debate, you often try to find the weak point of your opponent. You try to find the historical fallacy, the logical error. So you attack atheism at its weak point. But I'm not going to do that here. I'm going to focus on the new atheism at its strong point. Because I think that if you can meet it there, then you really have a pretty good foundation for affirming theism. Perhaps specifically Christianity. Now, in my debate with Christopher Hitchens a few months ago, he began by saying, he said, look, you Christians sicken me. He said, you go around with Jesus this and Jesus that, and what would Jesus do? And the basic idea here is you people seem to think that if you have Jesus, he's going to make you a better person. He's going to make you more kind, more honest, more just. He says, nonsense. Name a single virtue that a Christian can perform that an atheist can't do. Every good thing a Christian can do, an atheist can do. Every bad thing an atheist has done, Christians have done, and more. So God is superfluous. Stop bringing him into the picture. If there's a famine in Rwanda tomorrow, you can volunteer your time, you can write a check. He goes, I can too. Now, on the face of it, this is actually quite true. Christians can hardly claim a monopoly on virtue. I don't think any of us would claim that atheists are incapable of it. I want to make a different argument, and that is that if you look at the virtues and values that are affirmed even in secular culture or even by the new atheists, if you read the books of the new atheists and if you were to make a list of the 10 things that they value the most, Such a list would be things like the idea of the individual, the idea of dissent, science as an independent or autonomous enterprise, the equal dignity of women, the abolition of slavery, compassion as a social value. Well, my point is, these things came into the world because of Christianity. Now, how do we know this? Just look to other cultures. And you see that these values are downplayed, in some cases non-existent. Look at ancient Greece and Rome before Christianity. You find that these values are not there. For example, the preciousness of human life is, within Western civilization, a kind of Christian invention. The ancient Spartans didn't believe in it. If they found a child who was sick, they would leave it on the hillside in the winter and find it dead in the morning. That's not the scandal. The scandal is the great thinkers of ancient Rome and ancient Greece. Sophocles, Aeschylus, Plato, Aristotle, they knew about this. They viewed it with complete equanimity. It was to them no big deal. Why? Because the idea of the sanctity, the value, the worth of every human life, this was just not a big value, not an important value in classical antiquity. Now, I want to say a little bit, if I may, about science. I want to actually argue that science itself is based... if you listen to the New Atheists, they like to draw a contrast. Science is based on evidence. Christianity is based on faith. And then they go on to tell a very elaborate story, which I'll say a word about in a moment, about a war between science and religion. But I want to begin right now by contesting this idea that science is based on evidence, Christianity is based on faith. I want to argue that science is based on three faith-based propositions that can in no way be demonstrated by evidence. I'm not talking about science in its origins. I'm talking about science today. What are these three propositions? Well, number one, the universe is rational. Now, if you think about it, this is a little bit odd. You or I can be rational because we have a brain. The universe does not, as far as we know, possess a brain. How can a universe be rational? But modern science is based on the premise that it is. The universe obeys laws. This is even more odd. If you or I are driving on the street, we see a stop sign, we stop. We can obey laws. That's because we are intentional, purposeful agents. How can inanimate objects obey laws? In fact, laws that are describable in the intricate language of mathematics. We're talking about Kepler's laws of planetary rotation. We're talking about Newton's inverse square law, E equals mc square. How does the electron know what to do? You have to look to other cultures to see how strange this seems. The Muslim thinker Al-Ghazali, he says, are you telling me that inanimate objects can follow laws? Are you nuts? He says, the universe exists in the mind of Allah. Everything happens at every second because Allah wishes it. There's no other way for it to happen. In other words, I'm saying it is only in Western civilization, Christendom, that we have this idea of the lawful universe. And finally, not only is the universe rational and lawful, but the rationality of the world out there is mirrored in the rationality of our own minds. Now, this is perhaps the strangest fact of all. Why? Because if you think about it, your brain is made up of atoms and molecules and neurons and circuits. So why should the whirring that's going on inside here match the rationality of the world out there? Why should there be a one-to-one correspondence between the two? What is the reason? There is no reason. Now, if you are a theist, if you are a Christian, you can say, well, you know what? These three things actually make a lot of sense to me. I believe that God is omniscient, which is to say super rational, so he made a rational universe. I believe God is a lawgiver. He gave us the moral law, the Ten Commandments. It doesn't surprise me he gave us the physical law, the laws of nature. And we are created in God's image. We have within us a spark of the divine rationality, so it's not surprising we can comprehend the rationality of the world out there. But my point is, if you're an atheist, you can't make any of these assumptions. You have to take them 100% on faith. In this sense, even science is a faith-based initiative. Now, if you read the literature of the New Atheists, but let's go beyond it. We're talking, by the way, not just about Hitchens and Dawkins and so on. I see these guys as the Lilliputian shadows of the great atheists of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. Figures like Nietzsche and the philosopher Heidegger and Sigmund Freud and Karl Marx and Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre. This is what has produced this shift in our culture. So even if you open a textbook, an eighth grade textbook, my daughter's 13, you have a story, and the story is one of scientific advance and religious retreat. The basic idea here is that religion is rooted in ignorance. People don't know what causes stuff, so they say God did it. We don't know what causes lightning. The lightning God must have done that. We don't know what causes thunder. The thunder God did that. But the argument is, science shows that lightning is an electrical discharge. And once the thing is explained, the religious people become embarrassed, and they've got to find something else for God to do. And so there's a whole story here that through history, religious people come up with nonsensical ideas, like the earth is flat, affirm it for centuries, then the scientists show up with their brilliant telescopes and instruments and empirical mindedness, reveal that the earth is round, and that's the end of 1,000 years of medieval theorizing. It's a story that begins with the flat earth, it continues with Newton and Galileo, and it goes all the way through Darwin, who is said to have demonstrated, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that we can have design or the appearance of design without a designer. Now, I think that this story of scientific advance and religious retreat is largely a bogus narrative. It actually hangs, if you think about it, on only two or three pegs. And all those pegs can be individually dismantled. Take, for example, the idea of the flat earth. In reality, all you have to do is look at a little bit of history to see that medieval Christians knew full well, educated people in the Middle Ages, not in the Middle Ages, all the way back to the time of Christ, knew that the earth was round. Now, not even that. The ancient Greeks, 500 years before Christ, knew that the earth was round. Why? Because you don't need Galileo's telescopes to figure it out. All you have to do is look at an eclipse. Here's the sun, here's the earth, here's the moon. You see the shadow of the earth on the moon. Hey guys, it's round. Aristotle knew that the earth was round. Now, the other point about this narrative, by the way, is what it misses is huge developments in modern science over the past 100 years that strongly affirm the idea of a creator, and in some ways the very Christian idea of a creator. I just want to give one example of this, if I may. In recent decades, some of the leading scientists have asked a very interesting question, which is the universe, as we know it, operates according to a whole series of very specific numerical values. It's rather odd. If you look at a hydrogen atom, the mass of the proton is 1,836 times the mass of the electron. Not more, not less. And scientists began to ask, why does the universe have these values? We have all these forces in the universe, right? The gravitational force, which is so strong, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the so-called electroweak force. So one physicist, this is Lee Smolin of Princeton, he says, you can imagine God sitting at a desk with 100 dials in front of him. Each dial is very precisely calibrated to a particular number, the rate of expansion of the universe, the age of the universe, etc. And here's the question the scientists ask. What if those numbers were a little bit different? What if you sneak into the room and when God isn't looking, you fool with the dials, not a lot, you just move them a little bit, what would happen? Stephen Hawking discusses this question in his book, A Brief History of Time. And if you read that book, you will see that he notes that if you touch one of the dials, we're talking now about the rate of expansion of the universe, and you move it, not 10%, not 1%, one part in 100,000th millionth million. You would have no universe. You would have no life. In other words, the entire universe has to be as big as it is and as old as it is and have exactly the numerical values it does in order for us to be having this conversation. The whole universe appears to be a giant conspiracy to produce, well, us. Now, this argument, which is often called the fine-tuned universe, has put modern atheism completely on the defensive. By the way, I note it is an argument entirely immune to Darwinian attack. We are not talking about the transition of life form A to life form B. We are talking about the constants and values of the universe as a whole. We are also not talking about living on a lucky planet. That the atheist can explain. See, if there are millions of planets, and there happens to be one in which life is possible, you can say it's a big cosmic lottery. We just happen to have won it. We live on the lucky planet which can sustain life. That's not my argument. I'm saying that the entire universe has to have exactly the values it does in order for us to be able to contemplate it. So, I've said a word about science. I need to fast forward here a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about morality. I want to answer the argument that the atheists make that essentially says that religion, and specifically Christianity, have been complicit in the great crimes of history. And crimes that are still going on. Like a lot of specious arguments, this argument does contain a molecule of truth. I always tell students when I speak on campus, when you hear something that's bogus, always ask, what's the grain of truth in it? Because if an argument had no grain of truth, no one would ever believe it. So what's the grain of truth? Well, the grain of truth is that the Islamic radicals do what they do in the name of God. Listen to the Bin Laden videos. We're doing this in the name of Allah. The Quran instructs us, and so on. So yes, that's true. But there is nothing equivalent on the Christian side. Where's the Christian Al-Qaeda? Who's the Christian Bin Laden? Where's the Christian Hamas or Hezbollah? Where's the Christian country today run along the lines of Khomeini's Iran? It doesn't exist. So, for example, you find in the mainstream media, some of you may have seen recently Christiana Amanpour did her special God's Warriors, right? The basic idea is that the Abrahamic religions have a propensity to violence. One day she focuses on Islamic extremism, one day Jewish extremism, one day Christian extremism. But if you watch closely, you see the whole analogy falls apart. Islamic extremism. 9/11, the Bali bombing, the London bombing, the Madrid bombing, and on and on and on. Christian extremism. Well, here's Christiane Amanpour in the hills of Montana. She is standing outside a trailer on which a 75-year-old man sits in a rocking chair. This man, it turns out, wants to blow up the world. True, he doesn't have teeth or a job, but he's hoping one day to have the resources to do it. Be very afraid of this guy. So you see what I'm saying here, that there is a little bit of a sleight of hand, an attempt to equate Islamic radicalism with Christianity. But let's go further. I ask you, why are the Israelis fighting the Palestinians? Are they fighting over religion? Are the Israelis saying, well, you know what, we think Moses was the greater prophet? The Palestinians go, no, we think it was Muhammad, and they come to blows. Is that what the conflict is about? No. They are actually fighting over land. The Hindus and the Muslims are fighting over Kashmir. Even in Northern Ireland, they're not fighting about the Eucharist or transubstantiation. They're fighting over which group of guys is going to be ruling the country. Self-determination, not religion, is at the root of the conflict. There's a story about a man walking in Belfast when a fellow jumps behind him and puts a gun to his head and says, Catholic or Protestant? And the man says, actually, I'm an atheist. And the voice behind his head says, Catholic atheist or Protestant atheist? So, now, if you take a very brief backward glance to history, you see that many of the ideas that even some of us Christians sort of buy into are based on rather faulty premises. I consider myself reasonably well-educated. If somebody had asked me 3 years ago, how many people were killed in the Salem witch trials? I would say, I'm not sure, but it's clearly a blot on the face of American history. We all read Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, which is patterned on the Salem witch trial. I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands? Well, how many people were killed in the Inquisition? Well, that's clearly a kind of a biggie. It's lasted in Europe for hundreds of years. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. Well, today there's a rather reliable and extensive body of scholarship on all of this. And it turns out that when you look at it, Henry Kamen is considered the leading scholar of the Inquisition. He's got a multi-volume study. Turns out that the Spanish Inquisition, which was the worst, over a period of 350 years, killed fewer than 2,000 people. Now, I'm not a math major. 2,000 people, 350 years, it works out to about 6 guys a year. Now, this is unfortunate, but is this a world historical crime of any sort if you keep things in perspective? The Salem witch trials. I don't know if any of you have been to Salem. You can go there. The witches are doing pretty well. A lot of them are tourist guides. But if you take up one of their brochures, flip it open, a number of people killed in the Salem witch trials, you will find out it was, in fact, 19. 19. Now, that's 19 too many, I'll admit it, or 2019 too many, but come on. While these atheists are crying inconsolable crocodile tears over the crimes of religion that quite frankly occurred, what, 200, 500, or in the case of the Crusades, 1,000 years ago, crimes that are essentially unrepeatable today. I mean, what's the likelihood of having an Inquisition or a witch burning in Birmingham or in Fresno? These are crimes that have receded into the mist of history. Meanwhile, the atheists are ignoring the vastly greater crimes of atheist regimes, which have occurred not in ancient history, but in our lifetime, in living memory, and in fact, they are still going on. Now, quite honestly, I'm not just thinking about Mao in China and Stalin in Russia and the Nazi regime in Germany. It's true that if you just take those three, the big three, you will discover that in a relatively short time, about 5 decades, these atheist regimes managed to wipe out about 100 million people. Instructive to note, even bin Laden in his wildest dreams couldn't come close to, not even Stalin, not even Mao. Let's look at a junior league atheist, Pol Pot. He doesn't even make it in the top tier. In Indochina, in a space of about 4 years, he kills about 2 million. And we're not even counting Ceausescu, we're not even counting Kim Jong-il, Fidel Castro, Enver Hoxha, the list goes on. Now, Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion, says, but wait a minute. The Christians killed in the name of Christianity. You might have had tyrants who happened to be atheist, but they didn't actually kill in the name of atheism. Now, Dawkins, as you know, is a competent biologist. But I think this is the problem when you permit a biologist to leave the lab. Why? Because here's a guy who evidently has a zero understanding of history. I mean, you don't even need to be a historian. You just have to sort of crack open the Communist Manifesto, peek in there a little bit. You see that the atheism isn't incidental. It's quite central. Religion is defined by Marx as the opium, a sort of a drug that numbs people from seeing the world as it is. The whole idea is to create a new man, a new utopia, liberated from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. So my conclusion, atheism, not religion, is responsible for the mass murders of history. And I want to make a final point, if I may, and this is to look for, if I'm briefly, at the motives behind the new atheism. Now, the reason this is important, by the way, is there's a whole industry, not just the new atheists, in modern scholarship that attempts to understand the motives of religious belief. There's a whole school of thought that asks, see, the premise here is essentially an atheist one, namely that Christians and religious believers are irrational. What's the proof of it? The basic idea of it is that we are all rational in our normal lives. When it comes to religion, we lose all common sense. In other words, if someone were to come to you and say, your husband is having an affair, or your wife is having an affair, what would you do? You'd demand evidence. Where's the proof? Where's the photographs? Who's the private investigator? On the other hand, if someone comes to you and says, there's an afterlife, you have an immortal soul, you have no proof, but you're willing to believe. So the atheist assumption is that the Christian throws his brain out the window when it comes to religion. And the question is why? Why would people believe something that they don't have any reasonable grounds to believe is true? And the atheist answer can be condensed to two words: wish fulfillment. This was the theme of a famous book by Sigmund Freud called The Future of an Illusion. It's a very powerful idea that we believe because we want to believe. We are basically cowards. We can't face life. Life is tough. This woman here has diabetes. I need to have a hip replacement. We are all facing death. And so what do religious people do? They try to get away from that by inventing God, heaven. Heaven is adult Disneyland. Why? It's a place where there's no suffering. It's a place where there's no death, and so on. Now, for one second, I want to, in a very secular way, step back and ask, is this portrait of religion true? Is it believable? Imagine if all of us had come here to Latimer House and we decided we can't face life, life stinks, and so we want to make up a religion. We want to get away from it all. I can totally see how we would come up with the idea of heaven. Because heaven, after all, is in fact that place where all earthly tribulations are abolished. So heaven would fit my wish fulfillment scheme. But I ask you, would we in fact come up with the idea of hell? Think about it. Hell is worse than diabetes. Right? I mean, hell is even worse than death. Because death is just the end. Goodbye. Turn off the computer. Hell is eternal separation from God. Would we come up with the idea of Christian morality? Someone in the room stands up and goes, I propose the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments? I would strike out three myself. I mean, if we're trying to make our life easy, who wants a bunch of thou shalt not do this and thou shalt not do that? All I'm saying is it doesn't look to me like Judaism or Christianity fits very easily into a wish fulfillment scheme. But now I want to do something that is never done in these debates, to turn the camera around and ask this question. Not what is the motive of belief, but what is the motive of unbelief? To listen to the new atheist, those motives are entirely noble and very lofty. And the philosopher Bertrand Russell was asked after he published his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, what if you die, Lord Russell, and you find yourself before God? What would you say to him? And Bertrand Russell replied, he said, I would say to him, sir, you failed to provide me with adequate evidence. So this is the pompous pose of modern atheism. But I want to suggest that actually it is a pose. It is only the tip of the iceberg. Why? Because if you don't have evidence for something, you don't believe in it, and you just go about your life as if that something didn't exist. Case in point, I don't believe in unicorns, but you will note that I have not written any books. Unicorns are not great. The unicorn delusion. The end of unicorns. No, I just live my life as if there aren't any unicorns. There is a belligerence in the new atheism that's a clue to the fact that something else is going on here. Now, what? What is going on? Let me leave you with my thought about what it is. We all know, we all believe in justice and fairness and laws and courts, but life is actually kind of unfair if you think about it, right? Sometimes the bad guy comes out on top, sometimes the good guy comes to grief, and we say what goes around comes around, but not always, not always. Now, all the religions of the world are based on the idea that even though there isn't justice in this world, there is actually cosmic justice. Right? Think of the Hindu idea of reincarnation. You do something terrible in this life, well, you're going to be a cockroach in the next life. So this idea of accountability, in the cosmic sense, what goes around does come around. Now, here in Christianity, this idea is called the Last Judgment. And it's a very unnerving idea if you think about it. This notion that our everyday life, not just our public actions, but even our private actions and thoughts, are under external moral observation and scrutiny, this is a scary idea, not just for the atheist, even for the Christian. Augustine in his confession says he would defer his conversion. He kept praying to God, Lord, make me chaste but not yet. He was chafing under this idea of, you might say, unremitting moral scrutiny. And I want to suggest that the new atheism, and atheism generally, is a brilliant solution to this problem. How do you get out from the shadow of moral judgment? It's very simple. Abolish the judge. If you can get rid of the judge, there's no external morality. There's no Ten Commandments. Morality is not something out there. It's something more like a toolbox. It's rules you make up as you go along to make your life better. Now, I leave you with this thought, because the new atheism isn't just an intellectual phenomenon. Particularly for young people, it is also a recipe of moral freedom. It also says to young people, if God is not, everything is permitted. This was Dostoevsky's maxim. For Dostoevsky, it was frightening. You remove God and you get chaos in the world. But for the new atheists, this is actually wonderful news. If God is not, everything is permitted. I can do what I want. I'm not going to be held accountable in any final sense. So where does this leave us? If we're religious believers, I'll sometimes speak in a church and people will come to me and say, "But Dinesh, you know, this is very depressing news. Because what do you want me to do?" A few of them are very defensive. They say, I don't really want to hear any of this. I believe because I believe. And I say to that guy, okay, that's fine. But don't be surprised when your own son or daughter comes back from college and says, "Dad, how do you know that Christ was even a historical person? How do you know he even existed? How do you know that four guys didn't make him up?" You won't be able to answer. And then don't be surprised if your own children begin to drift away from the beliefs that you have inculcated in them. But then the more common line of objection is, "Well, but Dinesh, what are you saying? I'm an architect. Do you want me to become a historian and a physicist and a philosopher to go counter this new atheism?" And my answer is, no. You don't actually have to do those things. Why? The new atheists don't do them either. The new atheists just go out in the public square, they've got two big six guns in their holster, and they've got some very ready-made, cut-to-order arguments to silence the Christians. Religion is the main source of conflict and violence. Bam! Now, as Christians, you need some sort of bulletproof vest. If you're the nonviolent type, you may not want holsters, but perhaps you could use arrows in the quiver, or maybe some pellets to put in your blowpipe. So when the new atheist comes out there and says, "Hello, Christian, I got something for you." Bam! You step aside. "Missed me. I've got something for you." Bing! So, this is where we are today. We're in an age where we can't take assumptions for granted. We have to know not just what we believe, but why we believe it. It's not a substitute for faith, by the way. I look at apologetics as like clearing the brush, removing the mental blocks that prevent people from having an experience of Christianity, an experience of God. But it's a very necessary project in our time. In Scripture, we read, "Love God with our whole heart and our whole soul, but also with our mind." And I think we're in a time when these mental tools are very necessary. I've sort of been delighted to discover, almost accidentally, the Fixed Point Foundation. I think what brings our work in common, there's been Christian apologetics for a while, but most of it is in the Christian subculture, speaking in pastors' conferences, to youth groups. I think what I'm trying to do in my work, is take these arguments into the public square, into the secular campus, that's where I like to do my debates, into the secular media, onto the television shows, CNN, MSNBC, and so on. The idea here is to take a confident Christianity out into the world. 10 years ago, if we did this, people would say, "Why are you doing it?" In a strange way, the new atheism has put the agenda, put the issue on the table. So in some ways, if we respond well, the new atheism may even turn out to be a blessing. Why? Because it becomes a challenge, a provocation, and ultimately an inspiration for those of us who do have religious convictions, to go back to first principles, to go back to square one, and to come out into the world not only more strong, more confident, but also ultimately more persuasive. Thank you very much.